Mr. Segundo, are you divorced?
Well, of course!
Are you frightened by your ex-wife?
Yes, I mean, no!
Are you suffering from a disorder? Are you eating well?
These are peculiar questions, sir. What is this all leading up to?
You don't have to be ashamed, Mr. Segundo. It's nothing less than a disorder peculiar to the country.
Divorce? A disorder?
Can I pour you another drink?
Pour me too!
Okay, so I am here with Ken Kalfas, who is the author of A Peculiar Disorder Peculiar to the Country. My apologies on that. Ken, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thanks.
It's been suggested that this book is more cartoonish and outlandish than some of your Russian stories and the like. A lot of the other things that you wrote for Thirst are actually realist in some sense. So I wanted to actually ask you, do you feel it's important to continually try something different in terms of perspectives? How does this book relate to the thing? Do you have to reinvent yourself with each particular work? Or
Sorry for the dead air. I was just thinking about that question. Yes, I try to do everything. Every time I sit down to write, I try to do something different, at least different for myself. Usually something very different from my most recent work. So I always try to do something new. I can't say I have a single theme or style. I don't know about the cartoonish part, but the outlandish part, yeah, sometimes you want to try to push things. I feel this story required some great invention, and I wanted to make as much invention as possible with this novel. But yes, I try to change my pitches with each batter.
Gotcha. Well, the decision to actually tell this story in chapters pertaining to months, how did this come about? Is this really a pure allegory? I mean, it could very easily be read as that.
I'm not sure, but well, as a two-part question, I mean, in terms of why it's written or it reads very episodically, and that was a conscious decision. I felt that I wanted to discuss each of the strange things that had happened in our country in the past recent years. I wanted to do a story about 9/11. I wanted to do a story about anthrax. I wanted to do a story about the invasion of Afghanistan and then the stock market collapse. All those episodic events that were buffeting the public in those years, in the early years of the decade. The scope of the novel is from the World Trade, from 9/11 to the invasion of Iraq, and I wanted to treat with all these different events happening in our public life in the scope of this very bad marriage, this very, very bad divorce, and so yes, that was definitely a plan. And the first chapter was written as a self-contained short story, mm-hmm. and then I had the idea of writing other short stories, and then on that and putting it together into a novel, but that came somewhat afterwards.
Yeah.
As far as allegory, there's not a single allegory governing the novel, but each chapter and parts of each chapter have their own metaphorical relationship to world events. I mean, there's a chapter about the 4-year-old girl who's trying to make sense of the world that's happening around her. She can't quite put all the information together. And at the same time, there's some allusions to this FBI agent mm-hmm. who is similarly overwhelmed.
Yeah.
So I was trying to let those outside events govern, but not in a strict allegorical way that would pertain throughout the entire novel.
Do you think that the allegory was designed more with your language choices? For example, you have Joyce shopping for an opinion, which seemed to me kind of vaguely consumerist in terms of how she is grasping this. She hadn't read any political magazines
yeah,
before.
Yeah. But language, you definitely, I gotta tell you, it's shocking how far you will go to build a story around so you can make a certain choice of words somewhere in the text.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, but in that particular case, I hadn't actually thought. I think that phrase I've heard before. But yes, I mean, very, very much. Many writers, I think almost all writers, are really governed by their love of language, and that's an amazing part of what you choose to write. Yeah. by the words you want to put in people's heads.
Does a word choice along these lines, like choosing shopping for opinion as opposed to looking for an opinion, does this dictate some of the, I guess, ideological allegories or these kind of commentaries upon consumer culture?
They do. That did not. I mean, that was actually not. I think it's a good expression. I think it's actually a good piece, good phrase, good four words. But in that particular case, well, you know, we do shop for opinions. You know, I mean, you know, I don't even have to be that deliberate about it. Obviously, is that an interesting point you've just raised there? Because you know, obviously, we live in a very rich consumerist society. Not only are we wealthy in material things, but we're wealthy in points of view and opinions and shades of opinions. And you know, not only can you get mint chocolate chip avocado flavored ice cream, but you can also get pro-war, social liberal, internationalist choice of consumer opinion as well. So yeah, I think we do shop for opinions because there's so many out there, and we have the luxury of choosing them.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, you also choose the New Republic as the sort of vehicle for this, and choosing that name, the New Republic, is also likewise reminiscent of what is springing forth from the ashes of September 11th. Likewise, the soap opera that's playing on the television is One Life to Live.
You know, so, well, let me just, it's funny, you know, these are things I haven't even thought of. The New Republic, the choice of the New Republic choice was, that was the magazine, that was the liberal magazine, the magazine that Joyce might be aware of. Mm-hmm. She's not very political, but she's a New Yorker, and she is, you know, she's not political, she's not ideological, but that's a magazine she would recognize. So it was pretty, and maybe I myself had my own little obsessions about the New Republic's march to war. In fact, the current story I just finished is in part about a writer for a magazine that's very much like the New Republic. Mm. The One Life to Live, though, that was deliberate.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Gotcha. Well, I also wanted to ask you about the names. Harriman sort of suggests something hirsutes. And you also...
Hirsutes?
Hirsutes. Well, here, Harry, you know.
Oh, the last name of Harry. Yeah, well, I can just explain the names. You know, finding a name for your characters is not an easy task. And in some cases, you know, I've did my Russian... Actually, it's always difficult. It's always difficult to find the name that's going to sit properly on the character's shoulders.
Mm. Marshall as well.
Yeah, Marshall as well. Yeah, no, I had a lot of problems with. It was a lot of work getting names. In fact, well, I just say, I wanted a name that was somewhat neutral, but also kind of, sort of New Yorkish, and, you know. I was thinking of Harriman State Park and Avril Harriman, and I mean that's just in my. I don't expect anyone else to make these connections, yeah. But in my own mind, it worked, and you know, it just made me feel comfortable with that. And with Marshall and Joyce, you know, again, nothing deliberate. You know, I don't want people to take it too far, but you know, Marshall, and the word Marshall, M-A-R-T-I-A-L, yeah. Came to mind, and Joyce. To J-O-Y.
There's also Air Marshal as well.
Air Marshal, yeah. Yeah, I wasn't thinking about that, actually. I wasn't, yeah.
Or Sky Marshal,
yeah, 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 yeah. I was really, you know, you're trying to find words that you think are going, Marshal is a, you're trying to look for words that, names that are going to fit the characters, and not necessarily the first names you come up with in your notes, you know, and sometimes in Lolita, there's a list of, so towards the end, Humbert makes a list of all the students in the leader's class. Maybe they're all girls in the leader's class, perhaps.
Yeah.
And in the afterword, Nabokov says that it took him a month to come up with that list of names. I don't know. That may not have been true, but I can believe it. Yeah. You know, I mean, coming up with names is one of those difficult, sometimes undervalued tasks that a writer does. And I can't say, you know, a lot of my Russian characters, my Russian books have Russian names, and getting the right Russian names with those right connotations was not easy. Mm-hmm. Easy in my first novel, Comsariat of Enlightenment, which it's something about one of the sub themes is death and embalmment and preserving the dead, and the character's name, the main character's name, is his, before he changes his name for the purposes of revolution, is Gribshin. The word griba in Russian means mushroom. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to evoke that in my own mind. I don't know if other readers are going to get that. I don't think they will. But in my own mind, to make me feel comfortable with the characters, I need the right name. And I think everybody does that. You think of Harry Angstrom. What a great name. Why did Updike choose that name? Well, he has a scientific bent, and he was thinking about the vision of, you know, the unit of light, you know, measures light. He's a great seer. Part of Rabbit's grace is the way he sees the world. Yeah. So Angstrom is a great name. And then, of course, that offers a whole backstory for his family. You know, why do they have this Swedish name? You know, where do they come from? And it creates a whole little backstory for them. So these choices are have consequences for the novel.
Well, even using Joyce, she gets married and she gets the name Joyce Harriman. That doesn't quite seem right. It's almost as if there's something being unduly cleaved here, you know what I mean?
Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
I'm wondering, do you keep lists of names?
No, I don't. No, because you don't know what you're going to need until you sit down to make a character. Mm. So I don't. But you hear names, and when I was younger, my first, you know, I used to always go through the baseball encyclopedia and find obscure baseball players who with really great names, but even the obscure baseball players are no longer obscure, so, you know, but no.
Well, you were talking about notes that you start from. Do you have specific words on those notes that kind of trigger a perspective or trigger a particular mood that really help you to kind of focus in on something like this, which is a really tricky perspective to pull off?
You hope so, yeah. You try to come up, you know, when you're making your notes, if you're making your notes well, you try to come up with, you know, those phrases that we were talking about earlier that you feel might carry some weight. Maybe if you're lucky, an idea of a point of view. You know, you're hoping to get some idea what the voice is going to be like. The voice is really the most important aspect of the endeavor. You can't always get it in your note making, but you're hoping to get move towards it when you're making it and before you start your project. I think that's definitely the note taking is a very important part. That's what you asked me earlier before you started. Did I miss, you know, I've been here all week, I haven't really done much writing. What I would be doing if I had like another half hour in my day today would be making notes for another project and trying to get those that voice or ideas, a joke on the page or something like that.
How much of an inveterate note taker are you?
Not huge. I mean, I have a notebook that is my like my capital, you know. But I'm not like walking around the city jotting notes. I usually keep them in my head, and I can always at a point write them down in my notebook.
This may be a bizarre question, but it occurs to me: when do you know that something that's in your head needs to be jotted down onto paper?
I don't, and maybe I miss things. Maybe I sit down. No, I don't. I don't know. I don't know. I think when we write stuff, when we actually start to write something it's something that's actually pushing at you, and you feel somewhat obsessive about. And the notes really aren't that important in the end, because it's something you really feel and something that grabs you, and you don't need to have anything. You know, it will wait. for me at least, maybe I get older, it won't. I mean, maybe as I advance my later years, I'll need to be a better note taker. I don't know.
Gotcha. Now, I wanted to also ask you why you chose the third person as opposed to the first person. Did you feel, because there are feelings of hatred by these characters and feelings of absolute bitterness, that the third person being sort of slightly removed from their voices was the best way to make this comic and make this funny?
You know, I think the person you choose, you know, you know, is something, again, that comes down to something more elemental, like, you have some jokes on the page. Do they work better in the third person or the first person? You know, that kind of thing. I generally write lately. My two novels, and in recent years, I've been writing more on the third person. And I can't tell you why. If you notice, Philip Roth in his Zuckerman novels bounces back and forth, not in an individual novel, but from one novel to the next. And he's been asked about that question. He says, what feels right? And I know that's not really an answer, but, you know, you can see a novel and the voice, it's part of the voice, actually. You know, actually, it does matter, and there is a conscious. When you're deciding the voice of a novel, it's not just about the person you're going to be, but how you're going to tell the story. Which person it's in is a very integral part of that. And, you know, it's which they're saying I or he is important, but it's way down the list of other things you have to decide in terms of the voice. And just the most important aspect of voice is how close you're going to be to your characters, or how close you put the reader to their character. How far into their brains, how far through their, you know, how, and that those gradations are, making those decisions are extremely, I think most novels rise and fall on how well you've done that. So, of course, you can have a distant narrator. Even in the first person, you can have a distant narrator. But it's one of those many adjustments you have to make.
The decision to make these two characters essentially pick up where they left off while the rest of the nation is in mourning, why did you choose that? I mean, if we were to compare this, for example, to your finalist colleague, Jess Walter, with The Zero, he chose a completely different tack in terms of memory sort of deteriorating. Why did this, do you feel that the attention placed upon September 11th is this kind of your cynical response, or is this more the character's response? And
well, you know, the core of that first chapter in the novel, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, that first chapter was written in like October, November 2001. And at the time, I felt there was this huge, I mean, we're meant to think one way about 9/11, that there was a certain, and I don't want to call propaganda, because at the time, I don't know if I would use the word propaganda, but publicity or story or narrative. And the narrative was that everyone who was killed in the World Trade Center were heroes. They were all perfect spouses. You read they were all perfect spouses. They were all perfect husbands. They were all perfect co-workers. And at the same time, I was hearing a lot of different stories from people who were in the middle of bad divorces, and, you know, it gets to be a certain age, some of your friends start breaking up. And it occurred to me, a simple calculus, that, you know, if 3,000 people were killed and the towers came down, somewhere there must have been two or three secretly happy spouses. And from that little calculation came the idea of a story. And the idea of the story was to explode this myth that was being built up around the tragedy. And, you know, if everybody who dies is a hero, when, you know, everyone has messy lives. I mean, you know, everyone has lives that you make mistakes, things you regret, there's bad things you're in at the very moment. If in our death all that stuff is forgotten, we as people are forgotten. Our personalities are flattened out into myth, and I think that's a bad. I think that's a bad thing for us. It also separates us from the dead because they're not like us. They're better than us, better than we can ever be. So we do injury to the victims, and we keep calling them victims, you know, the heroes, and we do injury to ourselves, the survivors, and all those sentiments were loaded into that story. And into that novel. So that was the point of the story. And after I wrote that, I wanted to continue with the characters, and again, explode some of the myths we're building up around our public life.
In light of these myths, do you feel that you are more of a reportorial fiction writer? That fiction is meant to sort of, I guess, reflect these definitions, this taxonomy of who's a victim or not?
Well, you know, I don't think I'm not particularly repertorial, actually. At least not in this story, I don't think. I mean, there's some, you know, I think you take the work, you know, in this novel, not in every novel you might write, you take the materials that are around you and, you know, and you want to write about the time you're living in, and you hope to do it in a way that makes people reflect on the time they're living in. So, you know, that to me is a function of the novel, or can be a function of certain novels, and that's what I was hoping to do with this one.
Gotcha. Well, I also asked that because the locative details really reflect that September 11th environment. You suggest that Marshall might be employed by Cantor Fitzgerald, which is the firm that had the most employees die in the World Trade Center. You have Joyce working in one of the offices that was hit by the anthrax. So how does an environmental decision like this come about in the act of writing?
Well, you know, you're placing your... You have the story, you know, and this is all my... You have a story. I was actually thinking of so much of Cantor Fitzgerald. I didn't research them too much, but I wanted them to be in an office that had lost a lot of people, and I know Cantor Fitzgerald, but I didn't actually... I wanted to keep it indefinite, and in fact, I'm not certain they were actually in the same building that he was in. But you want to have... You want to make the story as plausible as possible, so you put these details in. And I spent a lot of time walking around New York trying to get angles on things. Taking pictures and, you know, taking pictures of. I usually do my research after my first draft, and I did. And this has not been this novel doesn't require as much research as my previous novel, The Commissariat of Enlightenment, did. But there was some, and, you know, getting the places right and figuring out, you know, where they might go for pizza and figuring out how many subway stops it is. And that's I always do that. I just finished a short story set in Washington, you know, and I was listening through the internet to Shadow Traffic for a couple of mornings just to get an idea of what the morning commute was like, yeah. You know. So that's the thing you do. It's easy, you know.
Do you find that writing in a more... in a setting that is more close to home, that you really don't have to do research, that it's largely an intuitive process for you?
It depends on the content of the story. I mean, I could imagine doing something else close to home that would require much, much more research. I had talked to people, this was something I worked on for several years, and I was always thinking about it, and I was always talking to people about it and looking for things and that's how I work. I mean, I do live in whatever I'm working while I'm working on it, and I am trying to figure my characters might be and that kind of stuff. So yeah.
Gotcha. There's one moment in this book, if you'll permit me to read this sentence, that really kind of, I think, kickstarts the narrative. And I want to read this to you simply because there's just a lot of commas. It's been off-cited. But Joyce felt something erupt inside her, something warm, very much like, yes, it was, a pang of pleasure. So intense it was nearly like the appeasement of hunger. It was a giddiness, an elation. The deep-bellied roar of the tower's collapse finally reached her and went on for minutes, it seemed, followed by an unnaturally warm gust that pushed back her hair and ruffled her blouse. Now, there's a number of things in these three sentences I want to actually comment upon. You have the commas, as I mentioned before, and it separates the specific thoughts that are going through her mind. But then you have this warm gust here that implies, well, this is actually about something more. This is about this kind of feeling that is running contrary to the national feeling that was depicted in the media. So I want to ask you how this particular section kind of came about. Was this one of the triggering points?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, this is how this novel began with a short story, and the short story began with the idea of, well, I don't remember exactly when I wrote it, but the idea of Joyce watching the towers come down was one of the, it kick-started the narrative for me too. I'm not saying the sentence was in that form from the beginning, but certainly I had a sentence that trying to do that kind of work very early on. And, here she is. I mean, it's not in those sentences, but, she's watching people die. She's watching thousands of people die. And this terrible, shameful pleasure is going through her, to me, that's, that sort of puts her in her self, all the contradictions that one might feel from that, feeling this pleasure and feeling this strange, shameful giddiness, I think the word is there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was a pretty key turn for me.
Did arranging these sentences with commas and clauses, very specific, literally two or three words at many times, did this kind of help you in the course of writing this to sort of pinpoint exactly what's going on through these characters' minds? I mean, what about arranging it into sort of small chunks as opposed to a grandiose sentence?
That's the rhythm of the writing. I don't even know. I tend to enjoy long sentences. But I can't. And maybe I have to look at it again. But very often, I follow a very long sentence with a very short one. Yeah. Like, yes, it was. Oh no, that was part of the same clause, I guess. But anyway, yes, I do like long sentences. Punctuation, let's get away with a lot if you can get it past the copy editor.
Yeah.
And I did there, so.
So in this case, it looks like you have long sentences, but they resemble short sentences by way of the comma,
You want these words to go off in the reader's head in a certain way. And you really do. That's what you're trying to do when you write. And sometimes you do that with commas, sometimes you do it with sentences, sometimes you do it with colons, semicolons. I mean, you do whatever it takes, you do,
Is it largely intuitive, this rhythm that you're looking for, or is it, how much of it is sort of planned through a kind of a psychological approach? Do you test this kind of things on other readers? Or?
No. But it is, it's a lot of rewriting, okay? I can't even say, if I look at it again, I might just want to change something in that sentence. So I sound pretty good when you read it. It's not intuitive. It's partly intuitive, and then you write it down, and then it looks like junk, and then you rewrite it again, and then you go over and over and over again. So there's it's a process making these sentences work. And quite frankly, I've discovered that's maybe the easiest thing about, the most pleasurable thing about writing is getting those sentences right. And maybe it's a lot of work, but in a way it's the easiest thing because you can always tinker with it. Plot and character are actually more, the big questions are the things that are more demanding when you're plotting a short story or a novel, when you're putting it out, make sure everything, all the major parts work. Getting the sentences right, you can always rewrite those little sentences, but once the story gets locked in, it's hard to shift things.
So for you, the sentence is more of the motivating factor than the actual plot and the character. I mean, the character's obviously...
I think that's true for everybody. I mean, I think we write, we love language. And, was Shakespeare really obsessed about the Danish, about Denmark, about succession in Elsinore, or fathers and son. He had some ideas for some great lines, and he found a story that he could use. But I think all of us come to writing for the love of language, and the stories come after that. I mean, that's in terms of, I mean, I started the story when I wrote a book or a project, but But I saw a way of using language in a way that would be interesting to me.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point, because people remember Twelfth Night not really for the plot, but if music be the food of love, play on. You know?
I don't compare myself. That's very awkward to compare myself to Shakespeare. But
sorry about
but,
that.
Yeah, I see an opportunity for. I see an opportunity to use language when I write. You know, I see where this story might take me in terms of language, in terms of phrase. You know, that's the elemental aspect of it. And you know, you want the story to have meaning. Obviously, the story is people, readers. However, you know, listen, writers write for language. Readers come to books for story, mm-hmm. and there's always a little conflict there. I mean, if you're successful as a writer, you're going to get them with the story. Yeah, you really. I mean, the story is a pretty prominent. Need for the reader.
Yeah. Well, there's a very politically incorrect quality to this book, and I wanted to ask you, do you feel that there are any limits you set upon yourself in writing this book or in writing any piece of fiction in terms of what you will savage or what you will skewer?
No. I mean, you know, you know, I write what I want to write, obviously. The limits on a writer are limits of his own talent or his own, you know, ability at that moment to think of something, to make something work. But in terms of what I could write about, I can write about, I live in a free country, you know, and I'm a free writer and I want to use that liberty as much as I can.
I'm wondering if the exuberance of this book allowed you to get behind any discomfort you might have felt in terms of having the anti-Semitic rant and things like that?
Yeah, I think it works because of the tone of the book. I mean, I think the exuberant tone of the book, you know, that particular chapter you just mentioned, when there's an anti-Semitic rant, there is a certain ebullience behind it, and talking about Israel. Marshall is—he's making these anti-Israel comments, and he feels this great joy in, you know, like being free. You know, like he can say these things. He doesn't even believe them, or may not even believe. He doesn't know what he doesn't care about Israel. He's just trying to get a rise out of these guys. But you know, so yeah, I think a novel like this will work. The humor works. The humor will work because there is this idea of. Well, a certain amount of exuberance in the hope in the writing.
Yeah. Do current September 11th novels, I mean, we still see a few of them, but during that year, of course, there were quite many, or at least
not
there was
that year. No, a couple years later. Yeah. I mean, that year there was, which year do you mean?
Your year, 2006. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
Do you think that there's too many of them that are kind of playing it safe, or have we reached a point now where the disaster, so to speak, is behind us enough for us to actually go ahead and really dwell upon it in these sorts of liberating terms?
I haven't read enough to make a blanket statement. I do know when I wrote this, when I first began writing this novel, it was with, you know, one of the things that people were saying was that irony is dead. And I hated that. That to me was like a real challenge to show that it wasn't dead and that I could still, that people could still write about these things. There was no one way to think about it. And in fact, it's been true. I mean, there have been. I haven't read that many of them. I mean, you mentioned I'm reading tonight with Jess Walter. His book The Zero is a totally different approach than not only from me, but from what people were saying. I mean, it's a great novel. And you know, I haven't read, but I would like to, some of the other. My wife recently read the Claire Massoud book, Emperor's Children, and she enjoyed it. And I would like to read those books. I don't know. I do know there was. I can't say this about literature, but I can say this certainly about the culture at large, that we were in a certain mindset about 9/11, and that mindset, unfortunately, got us into the war in Iraq. And possibly if we had punctured those cliches a little earlier, we might have been more critical of ourselves we might have made more critical decisions. I mean, the number of people who still walk around thinking that Saddam Hussein attacked us on September 11th is just astounding. There were other cliches abroad as well, you know. So I think that first chapter, as I said, I wrote it October, November 2001. I couldn't get it published then, but I wish I had.
Yeah. Well, can a novel really do this, really sort of live up to this task of puncturing cliches?
Yes, but novels do. Not every novel can succeed, and not every, and like, you know, but that's what novels do, sure.
Okay. Well, Ken, I know you have to go, but thanks so much.
It's a pleasure. Real pleasure. Thank you, Ann.
Thank you very much.